how to prioritize as a PM. It's a really interesting topic, and I think it's something that, as a product manager, it's worthwhile to give a lot of thought and theorize on. It's so integral to the role of a product manager to create a priority. It's when priority does come into play, it's a beautiful thing to see when it's clear across the teams that the engineers, the UX, the product managers, they're all speaking the common language. It makes building a product so much easier, and it allows for each team member to feel autonomous and that they can go off and create their value and have impact on the product and the customers in clear, effective ways. It's also interesting too in product management as a field, because what's in vogue one day all of a sudden becomes out of fashion the next day. It leaves the theory piece of it to keep us on our toes a little bit. But today I'm going to try not to keep you guys on your toes. I'm going to try to keep it pretty simple, and I'm going to have a spoiler alert. Where I'm going to go with this talk is eventually to suggest to you guys to just create a real simple list of priorities, just what your top 3 to 5 priorities are, and why your team should be executing them. That's going to be the easy part. I think the hard part, the challenging part, and this is where the product management role really comes into play, is to create that compelling story that really incentivizes, that really excites the rest of the team, the rest of the company to follow into it, to buy into your story, what you're selling them. So the first part of this talk, I'm going to focus just on giving a definition of priority, expanding a little bit of it here for a working definition for product managers. Then I'm going to extend that into how, once you create this priority, once you gather information to help make a decision on how to prioritize, how to put together a plan. And from the planning phase, we'll extend it off into the execution, which we'll just call this, for the sake of this talk, iterate and learn. And so we go to Google and get a nice definition, the facts or condition of being regarded or treated as more important. It's pretty simple, pretty basic. Great, could have just said, okay, Google, and gotten the answer. But where I want to go with this, and I want to relate it back to product managers, Satya Patel, who is the former VP of product at Twitter, had a great quote: product managers provide focus through prioritization. This quote came out of a topic that Patel wrote for the product managers at Twitter when he joined back in 2011. In the year that he was there, the product team tripled in size and the company grew even faster. It was in this scaling that the product role became very unclear. How they interacted with the engineering leads, with the UX leads, it was murky, and it caused for a lot of confusion, even an existential crisis of like, are product managers even needed at Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. And he put together this wonderful paper that still exists at Twitter, who are product managers. And this quote from there, I think, really captures a lot of the essence of the importance of prioritization to focus. And when we talk about something that's more important, identifying what's more important than anything else, what better place to start than customers? What better place to center and focus a team than to center them around customers? And as Jeff Bezos says, customers are always beautifully, wonderfully dissatisfied, even when they report being happy and business is great. This is a really interesting sentiment when we talk about prioritization. The concept of always being dissatisfied always leaves opportunities open for you to discover how to innovate, continue to build value into your product that allows you to tap into new markets. Being customer-focused is just a very valuable way to center your team and allows a lot of conversations to be simplified and prioritization to be understood when it's just brought back to the simple question of what value are we shipping, what customer value are we going to ship with this feature, with this release. And so when we talk about being customer focused, to have that customer obsession that Amazon likes to talk about, it really starts with knowing who your customers are. I know this slide is a little dense, and I just want to emphasize again that these are intended to be documents that you could all have afterwards as well and explore the different links in here. But to really truly understand who your customers are, You have to go out and meet them. You have to understand who they are. You have to feel their pain. You have to experience their pain. And I think a great framework to consider when going off and doing that is what Anthony Ulwick suggested with what customers want. He proposes the concept of outcome-driven innovation, which in contrast to using the customer voice as the key method, as the driving direction of discovery, of interacting with your customers, outcome-driven innovation seeks to get underneath what just they're saying, just what they say they want, to the true problems, to the pains that they have with the product, or with what they're trying to solve in their day-to-day interactions. So being able to answer questions like, who are your customers? What are their strengths and weaknesses? What jobs are they hiring your product to do? What are the desired outcomes of those jobs? What constraints are on your users? This really helps you to understand what potential opportunities are currently out there and what valuable products you could build to help better serve your customer needs. I always add a little pro tip whenever something like this, it borderlines on a dogma approach, is should always be suspicious. What this has led to, though, is a lot of interesting different counter articles and counter viewpoints on the web about the shortcomings of this as well, which is interesting and very well worth being aware of when you go into customer conversations with this approach. So far, though, it's served me incredibly well. I think it's a great way to frame not only conversations for myself, but also with the engineering and UX teams when we go into user conversations. So we'll be building on this a little bit as we go through this prioritization framework, show how this kind of folds into some later steps as well. And so once you understand who your customer is and what jobs they're trying to solve, the shortcomings of those jobs, another interesting framework to consider as well is the Blue Ocean Strategy. What Blue Ocean Strategy is really focused on is identifying those underserved needs. The two business management consultants who developed this strategy noticed that a lot of their clients kept going head-on into markets that their competitors were already in. They avoided those new markets because they were unvalidated. They associated those with greater risk. But in their studies, they found that those companies who do delve out into those quote Blue Ocean markets, those underserved needs, I would be like, he's over here in this example, which we'll get to in a second, that they found that they had as much, if not greater success, oftentimes significantly greater success, just because the output of the reward, the market that they ended up creating, was bigger than the one that they were going to go in and compete for. So in this case, Ringling Brothers had, this is a common example that they use in their book, and we'll just use it to those who are unfamiliar with it, just to understand the different points that when going to a circus, users would look for it. So things like price and star performer, animal shows, and such like this. Ringling Brothers focused quite a bit on sort of the traditional circus did as well. Cirque du Soleil, so it was not interested in replicating that experience. They saw a completely underserved market with the refined watching environment, the multiple productions, the artists, the music, the dance, and such like that, that Ringling Brothers didn't even touch on, and ended up creating a new market that grew to be bigger than what the Ringling Brothers had with the traditional circus. So this is something that I think could be extended into and considered when you're out doing customer discovery with your customers, with your user base. Identifying not only areas that you're serving them currently, and competitors are serving to our customer base as well when they consider the pain points that they're trying to solve, but potentially identifying those areas that nobody's touching yet. Those are great opportunities to go off and create a new market for your product, really expand what your market reach is for that. So the goals really coming out of Blue Ocean Strategy are just really focusing on what can you do to differentiate from the competition, and what could you do to deliver unique experiences. And so again, this will be something we've expand a little bit on as well as we go through. So now that we've talked about identifying who our customers are, what alternatives they have to use to solve similar pain points that you provide, another interesting question that I think is worthwhile to ask is around who do we want our customers to need help? This was a question that Stuart Butterfield of Slack put in his email that he sent to his company 2 weeks before Slack went into beta. Just a really interesting read on the company culture and the product culture that existed in Slack. I just wanted to highlight this piece of it because I think it's a really interesting exercise to not only consider who your customers are today, but who you want to make them be with the product that you're offering them. Any tool that you build is going to change the way someone behaves on a day-to-day basis. It may be a trivial change of a couple of clicks, or it might be something more significant, like Slack proposed, of just altering the way that people communicate from email to this more transparent tool. So when you consider what products, what areas you could look to deliver value to your users as well, it's also worthwhile to just understand what you are asking of them. What investment is required of them to get the reward that your product will ultimately provide to them. And so we have all these inputs. We have all these places that we could go, all these things we could do, but we need to present one cohesive story to the world. I really love this quote by Atjack. He was, in this context, talking about the role of, at Square more so, of product managers versus product editors, where he doesn't see necessarily product managers as managing the feature, more so as curating and editing, as they would in an editorial, making sure that the story fits, the features fit the story. I think after you gather this much customer information, and it's also important to note too that customer information should be listening for that feedback from all sorts of sources. Not just yourself going out and interacting with customers, but you likely have a whole team around you that's also interacting with customers, from sales to support to marketing, et cetera, who I'm sure have very strong opinions as well as where the product should go. But to truly understand what the customer pain that they identified, not just listening to what feature they heard that a user wants to build, you should still be looking for those inputs to bring into this discovery phase, so you could have a truly cohesive story. So I really like this quote. I kind of harped at Jack. He was a really interesting presence at Twitter. So that was a good place to transition into the planning for this. So after you gather all these data inputs, really about the customer pain and the problems that you're trying to solve, it's in the planning phase that I like to think we transition from the problem space to the solution space. And this is a topic that's really popularized by Dan Olson in the Lean Product Playbook. An excellent read. Just on how you stay focused on customer pain until you gather enough data points to start considering how you can be building a solution to solve some of those pains. And I think it's important too, when you're talking with customers, I try not to think about solutions. I really don't want to think about solutions independently. I have so much more fun when thinking about solutions with the team and brainstorming collaboratively with not just other PMs, but with engineers, with UX, with really sales support, SaaS, anybody who wants to get into the mix. Where I think a product manager could have that subtle influence is by having an ability to clearly articulate what customer problems that we're focused on. Be able to refine the problem, puts a perimeter on what type of solutions could evolve out of it, and I think it leads to a really interesting relationship with the rest of the team. So this transition from that problem to the solution space starts with the discovery of the market, of understanding who your target customer is, what their underserved needs are, and then bridging that gap into a product market fit. For the sake of this talk, I'm going to assume that for the remainder of the slides too, that the product in question, product we're loosely talking about, does already have some sense of product market fit. It's not coming out of a startup that's like three people trying to launch a new product, which is an exciting topic and I think worthwhile for its own presentation. I think it readily alters just some of the decisions that you'd want to be making in the later half of the prioritization model. So again, for the remainder of the talk, it'll be a little bit more focused just on having that product market fit and how to extend that value to potentially underserved needs and new areas. And so with that, we'll assume too that a product vision exists. And if If you guys are working on a product, if you have one now and you think that there's no real product vision that's published for it, that could likely be the case. I've seen that at different places as well. Oftentimes, though, it does exist. It exists in the heads of, definitely in the head of the founders and the CEOs, et cetera, but also in, I would assume, most of the employees as well. And so by explicitly articulating what the product vision is for what you're building, I think is an interesting exercise to do, just in that it brings everyone onto the same page about what tool it is we're looking to build. It stands for the motivation of building the product, and it goes in line a bit too with the concept of a mantra, which is similarly a concise, repeatable phrase that defines the team and the product. This distinguishes from the vision in the sense that the vision is the grander motivation for why we're looking to build this product. The mantra is intended to serve more as the day-to-day driver of why we're building this product, how it can help shape some of the decision-making process to keep that, make sure those decisions we're making embodies the team and the product. So for Google, it's do no evil, or for Twitter, it's been updated to it's what's happening. Keeping that sense of just urgency and just what it is that our company wants to embody is something that I think extends to all features that you should be considering and how to build them and to help guide the way and allow teams to be more autonomous. So as we transition in, we'll keep in mind these two concepts of product vision and mantra as we go more into the solution space. Another concept that I just want to throw out there as well, and I think it's an exercise worthwhile for product managers to explore, is the concept of portfolio thinking, which is pretty familiar in financial terms, in financial businesses, just that concept of how to maximize your return on investment, manage risk, and determine resource allocation. And so when considering portfolio thinking, what the output, what the goal of it is to really have quantifiable ways to identify the probability of impact versus the cost to implement a feature. So this spreadsheet, I'm hoping you guys can somewhat make it out. I'll explain it a little bit more too, just so we can walk through it a little bit. What the goal of here is to essentially put together an estimated impact of what we think solving a particular customer pain or being able to deliver on one of the jobs to be done would have for our product, for our customer base. And so we start with the information that we gathered in the customer discovery. We start categorizing it by some of the overarching customer pain categories that we identified. Those could be different areas of your current application that already exists. They could be net new areas or pain points that you're looking to determine. But an interesting way I like to start breaking those down when you identify those categories of pain is through the jobs to be done model, where a simplistic statement like when a thing happens, I want to have the output so that I can realize my business value. So it's essentially when something happens and something triggers in your app, there's an incident occurs so that somebody can make a more effective decision. In Fabric and Crashlytics, one of the common outputs or one of the common events that occurs with this is when a Fabric is and Crashlytics is a mobile development tool that's for crash reporting. So when your user's app crash, it reports back and aggregates logs of what occurred in their instance. So then the developers of the app can help fix it faster. When a crash happens to a user, one of our customers who's the mobile developer would want to be able to identify explicitly which area of the app that crash occurred in, so they can make the decision of when to fix it, either immediately or delay it because it's not a crucial part of the flow. And so we go through and create a couple of these through the information we gather through customer discovery. And over here we start considering the impact. So on the impact, we're using two blurry categories of areas this quarter that we're thinking are particularly important. So in this case, this is just acquisition and engagement. Oftentimes used similar like growth areas of either acquisition, activation, engagement, and retention, to explore which areas, where we think, these are just internal estimates of where we think having a solution for this pain, for this job to be done, would influence our user base. And so the next piece, before we get to the scoring, is just a cost. It's a swag by the engineering team just to give an estimate of what we think a feature like this would cost to both implement and maintain. I think it's very worthwhile to consider just the maintenance cost of some features. Quite a few of them could have significant carrying costs, either high onboarding costs to set up, just because they're more complex features that require additional support to bring the user up to speed faster, or just ongoing maintenance and the number of issues and support that's required to maintain it. So from there, we get a score, and that's just an initial basis for where we think internally one of these features could have an impact. And it starts giving us a gauge of when we start thinking about priority, where one of these could fall. And from here, then, the final piece of this exercise before I move away from it is to bring it back to the customers. We went out, we gathered all this information from users, we interpreted it, and here's our interpretation. I like to put it back out in front of those similar people that we interviewed to make sure that what we interpreted actually makes sense to them. And so a couple of really simple exercises to do are either to have just a survey with a scale of 1 to 5, how much of an impact would a solution have for you and your team, or a fun exercise too is a $100 investment. You have $100 to spread across these different features, how would you spend it? And you can kind of see the output of that over here. And that just helps corroborate that how we are interpreting as customers are interpreting as well. It gives more confidence, helps build the story of what we think the priority will ultimately be. And so as we're going through these exercises, as product managers and such, we also want to start thinking about how we can align and focus teams on success criteria and some common practices to use for that, particularly in Google. Objectives and key results, and also one issue is visualizing by success. And yes, this is a picture of Tony Robbins. I'm really intrigued by some of his visualization exercises, and it's fun to try to embody those with the rest of the team when we consider, here's the idea that we have at this point, here's where we think it's going to be X weeks, months from this date, just collectively coming together and visualizing that, so we all start talking to similar language. And so bringing the concept of customer pain, bringing the concept of product vision and mantra, what you're trying to build and how you're building it, to the OKR process, one thing we like to do is break it down in this format. And before we jump into it, we should explain a little bit about objectives and key results. Objectives and key results is a concept, to those unfamiliar, that was popularized back in the 70s in Intel and have since gained quite a bit of popularity in other tech companies as well. Google started adopting them in the early 2000s. They extended out to Twitter, Uber, quite a few other larger scale tech companies. I've also seen them in use at several startups as well. It's an interesting concept to really focus on what we're trying to achieve. You start with that, starting with that customer pain, what is the focal point of the solution we're trying to provide? Breaking that product vision as you transition into the solution space into something tangible, you break down that vision for the solution into objectives. And these objectives could be objectives that have to be sequenced out in order, where one depends upon the other, or they could potentially be executed on in parallel. So each one of these objectives coming from that vision of the solution gets associated with the key results. And a key result is something, again, that's measurable. You want to be able to ensure that you're leading success. And this is a topic that quite a few people have talked on at length. It's, I think, a key part of the prioritization model of defining success criteria. I do provide a couple of links to further explore, and also recommend Google search just to find a few other talks about OKRs if you're interested in learning a little bit more about this. I found quite a bit of success in centering teams around either common goals and objectives of what that ultimate product should look like and should do through using this simple OKR method. And so with OKRs in place, to extend that envisioning success mentality, a simple exercise, a simple but fun exercise to do is just write a sample blog with the team. It's just a simple structure to really hone your pitch. Identify what the product is, who it's for. Identify the problem that you're addressing with your solution. And then, most importantly, I think it's worthwhile to start thinking about how users are going to get started with this. How are they going to discover this feature? How are they going to interact with it with the rest of the product? How are you going to get them onboarded from this blog post, from this PR post? Are you going to be able to link them, drop them into a certain place? Or are they going to have to go through several other steps to get involved? I think these are all considerations and costs that you should be aware of before you deploy a feature or even write one line of code for it. So that, I think, are some high-level going through the planning process. That helps to refine the story that you can start looking to execute on a prioritized plan now to iterate and learn. And this is where we start getting to what ultimately the output of the prioritization model would be. And before we dive into that, just the last commentary that good product managers are always laser focused on what they can learn. This was shared by Hemal Shah, who was a product manager at Fabric in Crashlytics for several years and is now at Instagram. But he put together a really wonderful article about the modern day good product manager, bad product manager, and just extended some of the ideas from the original article into something today. And I think he did that with giving the credit and holding respect to the original article as well. And this, I think, is just something that we want to stay focused on when we're looking at things we can ship. It's not just about shipping value, it's about gaining learning. It's like, what could we learn about our customers today that we didn't know yesterday? I think it's some key considerations to when you're looking to build a prioritization model. And this is that simple top five list, that what is our number one priority across the team to go on and execute. And this comes from taking all the information that you gathered, putting it through several different planning models, and coming together with an explicit list. Why it's important to have an explicit list, and why I think something like this top five, while it's seemingly simple, is a really powerful exercise, is that when you identify what your most important and impactful project is for the quarter, it becomes at risk. It becomes easier to reallocate resources from your second, third, fourth, or fifth, or even potentially sixth, seventh, or eighth project on the list to help ensure that these are executed. And if the story is told and extended to the rest of the team, it's not necessarily it's not an issue. It's not a political, or it's not a, people don't question why am I going from one project to the other. It's known that this is being bought into, that this is the top priority, and this is where we could have the biggest impact by ensuring that this top priority goes through. While you're doing this, though, I think the other thing to be considered to consider as well is how to manage that sexy project stigma, where just because you're not number one doesn't mean it's not an important project that needs to go through. This is just what the most impactful product or project is for the current quarter or current period of time that you're in. And this project could have a lot of dependencies that several of these others are dependent upon. There's a lot of reasons for why this is number one and this is number two, and it's a worthwhile exercise, I think, for your teams to go through and understand. And so some other things to consider as well is we have identified, you might remember, the objective and the key results. The key result is serving as the hypothesis of what will happen when you ship this objective, this potential new feature, this new product. It's also important to identify what exit criteria is for the top five. You may want to either ship a new feature and let it sit out in the wild to gain some information to see how it tracks towards your key result, like what type of user adoption do you gain, how is retention or which metric you're looking to influence is affected. And that may warrant it moving out of this top list to not be so top of mind while you're gathering that information. So this, the top five is always very much a living, breathing document where these items move in and out as teams see fit. And so it's also important to be very transparent with these lists, to be communicative, to meet on it regularly, and review that these are truly your top priorities with either your product managers or your engineers on your team. It ultimately serves to be a very worthwhile and useful exercise. So with that, I just want to hammer home on one final point too, that the top five exercise, it seems really simplistic just to list out what your number one, number two, number three priority is. It could be a pretty arbitrary list. What becomes interesting and compelling about it is the story around, like, what customer pain are you looking to solve? Why are these more important? Why is this going to have the biggest impact on your product, on your quarter, on your objectives for the period ahead? If you're able to tell that story, this prioritization list becomes a lot more powerful, and it goes back to empowering the teams to be more autonomous, to make decisions on their own and independently, not having to worry about what the product manager or what the UX or what the engineer thinks of this decision, because we all have agreement on what the priority is, what we're trying to solve, and what the customer pain is that's most important to us. So with that, I'd love to open it up to some Q&A. If there's any areas of interest that you'd like to go into a little more depth on, I'd gladly do that.
Thank you, Dev. We're just going to, for the Q&A, we'll just raise your hand. We're going to give you the mic, and you're good. Good.
I'd like to talk a little bit about politics. Local, and Google's a big company, right?
Yes.
You got big customers in addition to many individuals and small businesses. But I used to work at Microsoft many years ago, and politics can play a big part of it, especially if you've got a particularly important customer or a customer that's been waiting on a feature for a long time that might not necessarily be driving a lot of revenue. To what extent does politics play in this?
I think it plays a huge part. And I think one of the interesting things to start with the customer-driven approach, the customer first, asking the question, not only what value does this feature bring to this specific customer, but what does it bring to our target customer? It helps posit the question. And those are difficult conversations to have. I'm not necessarily saying that there's a one-size-fits-all model for prioritization, but I think having a story of who our target customer is, what type of pain we're focused on, what type of objectives, what type of results we think we're going to have by shipping this feature, helps the rest of the group understand the trade-offs we're making by either pulling this feature in to this very specific customer, or pausing on it because we're trying to deliver here and gain like 10 other customers in this group that we're projecting. I think it's a very difficult conversation that politics plays. I think it's always worthwhile to be listening to sales, support, marketing, where they think the product should be going. But the stronger prioritization story that you have, the less you have to say no, the less you just have to say, well, here's what we thought our top priorities are, here's why. You tell me that this is a top priority, but it's only going to have this type of impact. It helps shape the story.
Okay. And finally, a few slides back on the key results or whatever. There you go. Do you break that down and into revenue also? We will assign an estimated sales and market opportunity of that key result?
Depends. Oftentimes right now, the team that I'm focused on right now, we're in a migration. So our key results are mostly how many customers are we bringing from one tool to the other. We're also considering as like health metrics we put in there as well, just how our current customers who are not migrating, how they're still seeing value, and how what their engagement and retention is using those metrics. So revenue does play a part, but oftentimes engagement, acquisition, and retention play a role as well.
So my question was about the product vision and
dogmatic. So at one point, does like our vision or the mantra behind it become dogmatic, or is it like because you've agreed beforehand with the vision?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think the product vision, to start with the mantra, is again very, it's intended to be a concise statement. And so it's not by any ways explicitly like the, it's very difficult to be constrained into a box with a particular mantra. So some of the ones we were talking about, like Google, do not know evil, Twitter, it's what's happening. For Crashlytics and the answers, you had lightweight yet powerful. These open-ended, these more just repeatable phrases are not necessarily intended to like explicitly state how you build a product or how you do it. It's meant to help influence the decisions you make. So where a dogma I would see is probably often like a book or something like that. There's a lot more details to what you can and can't do with this. This is more just like both the mantra and from extension of the vision are more guiding lights of why we're building what we're building, how we're building what we're building, ensuring that's this enough. Just
how you prioritize tasks in relation to key results or objectives and how that fits into the framework. Of like tasks, like how do you prioritize tasks and things to do, and how that fits into key results or objectives that you come up with?
So like tasks, speaking of tasks, like as in terms of like agile with themes, stories, tasks, or more just like bugs, backlog items?
Yeah, like the tasks that would go into achieving an objective or key result.
Yeah, so that I think actually it kind of gets broken down in a similar vein, you know, to some of these how we break down the categories into the jobs we've done. The tasks that extend out of this, I mean, this is also kind of getting into the considerations of the MVP, like what are the specific functionality that we need for an objective to hit its key results. How much of this objective do we truly need to build? How much of this feature do we need to deliver on? The tasks, as I'm understanding the question, seem to also fall under that similar framework where it's you use prototypes, customer feedback to just understand how much value you think this is actually driving towards that ultimately that key result and ultimately resolving that customer pain that you're solving.
Hi, I work at a game company, and we adopted OKRs a while ago. And one kind of thing we run into a lot is the objectives. The kind of two questions, like objectives and key results, sometimes get blended together. Like, I want to win the Super Bowl. Like, what those are the key results of winning the Super Bowl? Like, is that objective and key result? Obviously, measurable key results is important. And the second thing is, we also do hierarchical, I guess, OKRs, where kind of this big goal, but it's just kind of smaller OKRs that have kind of dependencies. I'm just curious if you can talk about it.
Yeah, that's great. I can start with the second one first, and I can see the first question. So the hierarchical, I'm assuming it's like kind of different layers are from like the top are kind of going through different layers of management, et cetera, down to the teams executing. I think those are great. I think it's a great exercise to consider at team levels. I wouldn't necessarily extend OKRs to individuals or be too concerned about working on individual OKRs, but I think there's a lot of value in how leadership can help, especially when there's multiple teams trying to execute and solve a similar problem, to keep everyone aligned, to have those higher level OKRs that the other teams drill into. The key of it, though, is having that clear, ambitious, measurable OKR. Saying you want to win the Super Bowl. One metric that's always used, too, is being able to score it as well. Like, usually on a scale from 0 to 1. Just, like, how close to achieving this objective are we? To say, like, we're going to win the Super Bowl, it's hard to measure on that type of scale. I mean, you could probably associate a probability to it from, how far into the game you are that you're likely to win, etc. But something like that, I don't think would necessarily be clear or easily measurable. You probably want that. I would look at that as more something like the objective: we want to win the Super Bowl, and like, what could we do to? What key results could we include to help drive that outcome?
So you actually talk about like prioritizing different features, but a lot of tech companies, they can be very engineering focused with good reason. So how do you balance the feature prioritization versus the tech that the engineering wants to do?
Yeah, I take it back to the customer pain. Like, if customers are unable to use our product because of tech debt, that is a pain we should look to quantify. Like, how impactful is that to the different metrics we're looking to score on for the upcoming quarter? I would see something like tech debt would probably likely impact either retention or even initial acquisition. You log into this new product, you experience a bug, not a good feature, not a good experience, it takes you off.
But like, if you're trying to upgrade technologies and stuff, you're essentially setting up for the future and there's no impact yet. But if you leave it like that, the whole thing is crumbling down, and that's really hard to sort of plan for. Like, it takes a lot of discipline. So how do you convince your business stakeholders about that? Because as a PM, you understand that, the engineers understand that, but your business stakeholders oftentimes, they're like, well, it's working now. And
had a similar experience with that at a startup as well, where we had to just rebuild the entire back end, and it was painful because we got to slow down on net new feature growth for quite some time to get this up. It obviously took longer than anticipated, and there was more problems and bugs, etc. I think it goes back to, again, that customer-driven focus. It's, okay, we know who our customers are today, but who do we want our customers to be? And in that situation we were in, the infrastructure we had couldn't serve those customers we wanted, who we wanted them to become. And that was easy to start quantifying back when we looked at our OKRs. We were talking about, we want to have X number of customers at this size, at like mid-market or enterprise, and we know we can't get them because we don't have the infrastructure. And once we started presenting the case in that light, as painful as it was to the rest of the company, they at least supported, some begrudgingly, but they supported the effort. It gets a little dicey when things go longer than anticipated. I think it's just the consistency of bringing it back to who you want your customers to be.
So you talked about top five priorities and somehow in the deck, as you talked about, it sounds like they're all distinct and very clear, very easy to sandbox each of these priorities. So priority one, number two, number three. In real life, it's never so distinct. It's all interdependent. And so how do you handle the fact that as time progresses, your priorities change, which means immense changes, the decisions you made in the past might not be able to harness in the future. So how do you do that?
Yeah, 100%. So that goes back to that, the emphasis on this being a living document. So the team I'm on, we actually meet at a weekly cadence to talk about our top priorities. We walk through them. We don't necessarily reprioritize every week, but we walk through, do a status check, make sure that the projects are at risk. And if somebody gets an itch or just a feeling that, you know, why is this still number two? Or why is this number three? Why shouldn't something else be that? We'll make sure to take a point to take time to discuss why these priorities are in this case. So it's the importance of doing something like a simplified list, I think, only exists if you commit to it. It's something that you have to keep front of mind, if not at a weekly clip, at a bi-weekly clip, just discussing and evaluating why these are in the order that they're in. If things do change, which they very much often do, why are we moving one to three or three to one? And have clear understanding that's then communicated back to the teams on why that decision was made. And again, the importance of exit criteria, something like lingers. If it's unclear of when something should be taken off the list, that leads to a lot of dicey conversations. So having clear exit criteria, what it means to move something off of this prioritized list of this watch list, is also, I think, very important to those conversations.
What you're saying is great when it's about features and feature priorities. When you think about product priorities, that doesn't scale really. For example, if you say features are the most important thing for the product and then comes schedule, for example, that's great until it takes too long and suddenly schedule becomes very important and features takes a backseat. And then how do you, all the decisions you've made up until then might not be valid in that case.
The schedule?
Yeah, so let's say schedule is very important now because of the feature priority, things have slipped. So now, if that changes priority, the decisions you made in the past leading up to that point have to be reevaluated.
Yes, I mean, it's I don't want to emphasize this being feature-based because it's oftentimes again back to that customer pain, like what customer pain are we solving with this, with these objectives. I think when schedule starts slipping, that's also part of that portfolio mentality. Like you want to have, when you consider the top five, you want to consider the top five from a portfolio perspective. And that portfolio perspective would suggest you to ask, okay, how many of these are a high risk, high potential impact product that we don't know that the schedule is likely to slip on it? Versus how many of these are smaller risk, but only deliver incremental value, but at the same time, we're able to ship something and kind of continue to deliver that value to customers. Like the product doesn't feel like it's going dull, it continues to stay sharp. So I think it's a risk, and it's a risk with any product that you're building, that you say we're gonna finish it in this time and it takes 2x that. That is something you have to deal with. It's a tough conversation, again. And I think the simplified list does help keep that conversation going, because it's, okay, all of a sudden it's taken us twice as long to build this feature that we thought. Is this still gonna have as big of an impact versus the return on investment as we initially thought? If so, should this be removed? Should we consider the sunken cost that we threw into this product, or should we just kill it off because it's not going well? I think it's also important, and not part of this talk, is just how you build features too. And I think a thing that is instilled in a lot of our team's DNA is the concept of just always running experiments. What's the lightest weight experiment we could run to prove out that we're going in the right direction with the product that we're taking? So this could be anything from a customer interview, a customer survey, to a prototype, to mocking something up in Excel and just seeing if the information that's output from there is of value to prove before we commit too many resources to it.
Cool. So I think on paper a lot of it is very methodical. Like you're, going through the blue ocean strategy, planning, figuring out who your customers are, figuring out the key problems, and then developing the solutions all the way down to kind of like the tactics and the stories. I guess my question is, how do you allocate your time between kind of like strategy, the forward-looking thinking, versus kind of like the tactical stuff that you have to do, and then. Yeah, and how do you, what's the ideal allocation of that, and what do you currently do?
Yeah, I it's a great question. I think it's really tricky with product to stay focused on the different areas that you need to, not get pulled into like in that janitorial role where you're just cleaning up messes or putting out fires. It's a simple tactic too, and it's just kind of like back to that portfolio mentality of where do I want to spend my time? It depends on the situation, but like currently, there's a lot of questions about strategy as we bring together two products that we're working on. So I'm focusing more of my time, I'm allocating about 30-40% to that. I break it down to the different horizons. So like horizon one is just like the tactical interactions that we're doing. Like what is the team delivering this sprint, this week, next week, the next 2 to 4 weeks, we'll say. To the second horizon, which then becomes up to about 6 months out, and the third horizon is 6 months plus. Just like what are we doing? What direction are we going? And from that breakdown, I just put out, like, I gauge, just given the situation, like, okay, I want to spend 50% of my time on the tactical day-to-day, because I know the team's getting up and running in a new environment. I want to spend 30% of my time on that H2 horizon, just defining what that strategy is. And then the remainder, the 20%, on that longer-term vision, because we really need to define that in this new space as well. And as those things start coming into line, like as we start getting buy-in on the direction we want to go, this long-term, it's less spent on that long-term strategy, so that'll drop drop down to like 10%. And if this other area comes back down to 30%. These are all just, gauges that I say, okay, I wake up, I start the morning, this is what I want to do. If a fire comes up, if something happens that like we need immediate attention on that draws me away from it, it's difficult to stay focused. But like at the end of the day, if you put that model in place, it's something that you can measure yourself towards, and you can just look back and reflect. When you do retros and such, just consider how you allocated your time as a product manager over the week and see if it aligns with what you anticipated.
Hi, I'm a PM for a health tech startup, and one of the things that we struggle with is getting the engineering team to swag the medicals. So do you have any tricks on how you do that, and to what degree do you have to spec out all of the features before you bring it to them? Is it in a structured manner, or how do you get them to swag all of those things that you're trying to prioritize?
I think like broadly and a little more generally and ideally speaking, building trust with the engineering team is the number one like interaction to focus on when joining a new team and trying to get an idea of direction like where you can go. I don't like spending much time on taking these guesses and estimates of what we should be building. I don't like writing PRD or product requirement documents, things like that, like into full-fledged detail. I like redlining documentation, just the minimum amount needed to keep the team happy and focused in the right direction. I get pressure to write more from other areas, oftentimes not from the team. I think it's also like a consideration too, at a larger versus a startup, where the number of people who's curious about talking to you what you're working on is probably larger at a larger space, so more documentation is helpful. But yeah, I think some basic exercise. I would keep it simple. I would not, when we point out, like do exercises to point out or like estimate out how big a project is, we don't go, we use the Fibonacci sequence, and don't go higher than 8. If anything scores higher than 8, immediately it's pulled out of consideration and just rewrote it down, because it just, we feel it needs more thought. That also alleviates a lot of conversations. When you have somebody who throws out a 1 and somebody says it's 40 or something ridiculous, like that's a conversation I did not need to be a part of. So ultimately though, like in some teams we don't even do too many exercises. We consider what we could get done in a week or in a sprint. If the team feels that, you know, we think we can get this done, we break it down accordingly, we task it out, and if the tasks kind of show some things that pop up that we weren't thinking about initially, it's like we reassess and we address that, and either pull it into like extend the amount of investment we think we're going to make on it, or we trust the team. And more often than not, like at the end of it, the more spending so much time thinking about estimates and just kind of like not giving a shit about it, the output at the end of the sprint is often the same. We either hit the goal or we don't, and it doesn't seem like it one way increases success over the other. I would just say on the documentation front, to redline documentation is the minimum amount needed to get stuff out the door, because that is not always that fun.
Yeah, so you've talked a lot about making priorities and what leads to it, but as someone who's worked with operating systems, I have to say that priorities are also not absolute. For example, if your computer only ran the highest priority programs, it would not be very fun to use. For example, what if the kernel ran all the time and didn't just take out the time to process any user input? That would not be very good, right? So similarly, when it comes to the priorities you have made, they cannot be absolute. And especially if you have a very long list but only looking at the top 5, those top 5 could be very close together, and you might still have to spend significant effort to things that are not the first, second, or even the second priority. So how does the hierarchical ranking translate into like the amount of work you actually have your team put into each particular priority? Because as I said, it's not a strict well ordering. There's room for moving things around.
Yeah, that's a great question. So just touching on that point too, that these priorities are by no means absolute, and that's why at any point these should be up for discussion. I mean, preferably at some sort of regular cadence where teams could gather around and consider what your top priority is, to evaluate all the inputs that you considered last week. What has changed since last time we considered this? Is this still valid? Is this our best estimate as to how we could have impact? I think a lot of this goes back to that concept of the portfolio approach, portfolio thinking. Making statements around what type of impact, the probability of that impact occurring through executing on some of these different objectives. Considering that when you have this list, I think it's not necessarily about building that absolute model. So you're right, this isn't an engineering binary one-zero solution. It's not absolute. It's telling a compelling story that allows a team to move in a common direction. That is the ultimate goal of this. It's always going to be challenging to get everybody on the team, everybody on the company, operating in the same direction. The goal with the prioritization model, this is the output, but the importance really comes on the story leading up to why these are here. And that's, I think, the thing that I would more emphasize. If you feel like this priority, if this top list is lacking, I would, rather than evaluate the list itself, I would go back up and evaluate the customer discovery you did to understand what problems you could be executing on. Where could you be delivering value? Are you delivering the most value in these different areas? Rather than just looking at this like a list written in stone.
I understand that in Agile you typically have fully autonomous teams, but sometimes that's not the case in large organizations. And sometimes the features that you are developing have dependencies on other teams. And so my question is, how do you manage the dependencies, and if they cause your deliverables to fall off schedule, how do you manage that expectation with your stakeholders?
Yeah, it's a great question. We were actually kind of talking about that earlier today as well. Google has a lot of dependencies, and it's really difficult when you think you have a good idea that requires an integration with another application or in the organization to say that, like, hey, we should both be working on this at the same time. It's a difficult conversation to have and a difficult conversation to get that buy-in on. I think one thing we were talking about to help alleviate some of that is with priority, if you are looking to have dependencies with another team, to get them aligned within a similar planning process, to bring them in, to get them bought into the prioritized list, get them to agree that this is the top priority that we're going to execute on and actually commit X number of resources to. If that team then ends up falling short, I mean, that's kind of like managing your own team slipping, like you thought you made an estimate and it was delayed. Outside of clear communication, I think reviewing the prioritized list, you also get a chance to call out what projects are at risk. So like anything else, just communicating as soon as possible that you think a project is at risk is, I think, the best way to approach it, because then it allows you to say, okay, well, we got this project number 5 that has resources allocated to it as well, but if one is at risk, why don't we reallocate resources to help out with this and help drive it forward? It's a difficult conversation to have with dependencies. It's always great to try to minimize the amount that you have, but when you do have them, I think the best way is to just focus on communication and alignment. Like, make sure you both have the same commitment and you both committed to the same schedule of delivery.
Hi there. I have 2 questions. One is, what product are you managing? And then the second question is, what tools do you use day to day? And if these are Google in-house tools, then what tools do you recommend a PM or prospective PM should get really familiarized with?
Cool. At Google, I'm a product manager of Firebase. Firebase is broken into several teams. The team that I'm on is called the backend as a service team. So I'm working on a feature now called Cloud Functions. And I came over from the Crashlytics acquisition from Twitter several months ago, and we're focused on how we can use Cloud Functions to help deliver value to Crashlytics users and get them migrated over. Tools that I use on a daily basis. There are, unfortunately, a slew of internal Google tools to just help with the scheduling, the processing, getting stakeholders and everybody approved on legal and privacy and such like that. I don't recommend using those tools. they're not the funnest part of my day. Tools that I use personally, though. What's really interesting, too, is this latest team that I've been a part of, and they have, again, by all accounts, been just a great team to be a part of. So now I use Jira. They use this tool called Blossom to manage our backlog. And it's like Trello, but even lighter. I was very skeptical at first because I've been a Jira user and not necessarily an advocate of that one either. It's an interesting tool. I think it's kind of opened up my eyes to the importance of building trust with trusting communication with the team, where you don't necessarily need a form of Jira to have an understanding of like, the value you're going to deliver with shipping the story. So I'd recommend looking at like some potential lightweight tools for backlog management, either Blossom or Trello. Use a lot of Excel, as you've seen. We do have to write a lot of product requirement documents, and that's done in Google Docs. But then I always like to use as few words as possible when I'm writing requirement docs. So visualization tools like flowchart tools, draw.io is really cool and integrates really well with the G Suite. Just building out those flows is nice. Calendar. I use a calendar a lot. Lots of meetings. We like Slack. As part of the acquisition, we were able to get Slack to be used in Google, not the case, so I don't say anything. But that's some sort of chat tool with the development team is really crucial to have. Well, a lot of discussions are going on there. Being a part of that is essential. And Dex, a lot of Dex.
All right, we're going to take two more questions. It's going to be Mr. here and the lady over there.
Hi. So I'm a product manager for a product which has both internal and external customers. And sometimes it's very difficult to do prioritization because the external customer has a direct revenue impact, and the internal customer is like, oh, we just need this because of X, Y, and Z. And it's hard to associate a revenue impact there. So given that kind of, I guess, innate bias, how do you go about prioritization?
So I think the first question that I would ask is what in particular, like why are you building for internal customers?
So it's kind of they want to use it for monitoring certain things, but they want to sell that to customers.
So it helps your, I mean, but like the tools you're building for the internal team are also helping you serve the external customers.
Right, but sometimes the requirements are broken. So some, like, so the internal teams want something very specific. So yes, that is important. Yes, that works to drive talks, but it's hard to buy the external distribution.
Yeah, I'm kind of correlating it to some exercises you went through where we were trying to automate just like internal purchase flows. Like, you know, if somebody makes a purchase of a certain amount of price, that they get their information gets pushed into Salesforce so that the sales team could then go execute and like follow up as a lead and potentially get from there. And so the way we went about in that instance to make a case for not doing this was what type of impact would this potentially have? How would this improve the sales team's ability to increase X number of leads, and if X number of leads, if leads increasing that is our goal for the quarter, or for the period of time that we're looking at, then this should be evaluated with other ways that we can improve lead generation for that time. If this turns out that if we think that this is the biggest impact we're going to be able to have by empowering the sales team, then by all means we should do it. We did do that. was mixed results. it was a tool that I would not recommend using that we used to build it, and it ended up taking one of our senior engineers. It was supposed to be done by the sales operations person with his GUI. It was a disaster. It ended up like one of our senior engineers had to jump in, and it was messy. But yeah, again, I just correlating it back to the external customer value you're going to deliver, and then also having a clear understanding of what objective you're trying to, what key results you're trying to move over the period of time, and making the case that way. If somebody insists to know like politics plays a huge part in this, if you know somebody super senior says no, this needs to be done, it's like you can make a case, but there's not much you can do.
Thank you. Alright, last question.
So how do you deal with difficult customers? So we tend to have issues with them. You know, we have a project plan, but like 3/4 of the week flip-flopping or wanting to accelerate the timeline. How do you deal with that?
It's accelerating the timeline in terms of like the...
Or like pushing up the timeline to be
aligned. Yeah, that... It's difficult, and that, I mean, like, it requires a close relationship with the sales team, and I think also with, like, support and success teams. I think the first thing is always most important to understand, like, when you have an actual customer, it's no longer, like, you're not trying to close a deal, you're trying to maintain a relationship with this user. And I think the best way to do that goes back to being clear about expectations. Like, if you say we're going to deliver a certain feature, be clear that we're going to deliver it in the time that we say we can deliver, and if it needs to be, if they start suggesting that it's accelerated forward, you know, that's where it becomes a balance of, well, we only committed to this, we can't pull all our resources to build this out sooner and faster, do it differently. That, I think, takes partnering up with some of the like support, success, and account management sort of teams to understand who that customer is. Are they requesting a feature that is something that you want your target customers to, that's going to serve all of your target customers? Is it a one-off instance for just them? I think that could help make a case to bring it up, to like bring in the work sooner. But outside of that, it's kind of back to the political game too. Of okay, if we executed on this for this customer, it'll influence metrics this much for this period. Whereas if we would have kept the course, we'll influence the same metrics by this. Should we trade off? That's where I think having that clear prioritization helps out with a lot of these conversations, having those OKRs in place to align the teams on what you're trying to achieve over a given period of time. Simplifies, but still makes those conversations a bit challenging.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.